Last week, if you remember, we were in Acts 23, and we were dealing with the occasion before the Sanhedrin. So Paul is taken by Lysias, who is the chief commander in Jerusalem of the Roman centurions. He brings them to almost, I guess what I called last week, mediation, trying to not take it to a court trial, and that failed. So if you remember, there was a attempt to assassinate him by 40 Jews who made a covenant together that they were going to kill him. His nephew informed Lysias of what was going on, so he summoned 470 men to take him to Caesarea and to stop on the way at a city, what was that city called? Antipatris, something like that. So the total journey was about 65 miles that they traveled. You can see on page number 4, just kind of a map of where we were going, from Jerusalem to Antipatris, where he stays overnight, and then he heads north up to Caesarea. And so this picks up with him having arrived and awaiting basically his accusers to get there, right? So this is all in accordance with Roman law. So in my mind, I think of just going through a court trial, right? You have the right in our government to be confronted by your accusers. So that's obviously what's taking place here. And as we left off last week, we just noted how they were going to bring what the King James calls an order, but what was just an attorney is what really they're referring to. So the Sanhedrin hire an attorney to come and to represent them in court, and he's going to be the one making the charges against the Apostle Paul. Now, I don't strongly infer this, but seeing as though they're a powerful religious entity, if you think of any powerful group of people, you're going to hire connected or good attorneys. Based on the way that Tertullus, I guess that's how you pronounce the attorney's name, presents himself, the things that he says that are very subtle, but it just seems to imply that he's either connected, maybe he's trying to intimidate Felix. There just seems more to me than meets the eye a little bit. I'm clearly reading into that. You don't have to read that into it. But there's just two or three very minor comments along with the context of the situation that they're the most elite religious organization in the area that seems to me to suggest that, and then the way, that Felix responds to it. Seems like by the end of this, there's a clear decision that should be made. It seems like Felix knows that clear decision, but he refuses to make it in order to help one side of the group, of the case. And so all of that part of the story just seems like this is definitely slanted against the Apostle Paul. But even in saying that, we have to remember that man determines a lot of things, but in the end, God's purposes are carried out. That helps us, the situation helps us, if it is true, what I'm inferring from this, that even when things are slanted against us, we don't need to panic as if God doesn't even have a purpose in what's being carried out that's unjust. When things at work are not fair, when the promotion doesn't happen, when the scholarship isn't given to the one who qualified, when whatever, God's hand is still involved in things. And Paul the Apostle here, he knows he's going to Rome. As we alluded to two chapters ago, it does not tell us that that was going to occur through some just and painless means. Rather, it's going to come through punishment, through imprisonment, and through, frankly, an unfair trial. It's going to get passed on to what we would consider today an appellate court, and it continues to be unjust. And yet, it is through these vehicles that God brings about his end. And that just shows us the incredible wisdom and power of God, that he can take unjust human sin, just like he did in the crucifixion of our Savior. You have unjustness everywhere. You have betrayal everywhere. You have denial of friendship everywhere. And yet, in the darkness, God accomplishes the redemption of mankind. And again, the application to us, to me, is very apparent here. That even when man coordinates evil, just like he did with Joseph, God can intend it for good. And so here's another example that I read, although it's a smaller one in comparison to the other more clear examples. And so here we pick up on verse 1, Acts chapter 24, and it's broken into three brief sections. This is going to be the case against him. It's going to be his response, and then kind of how the judge, I say, decides in the case. What he does as a response to the case is kind of the three ways that we've broken it up here. So it says, "And after 5 days, Ananias the high priest descended with the elders and with a certain order named Tertullus, who informed the governor against Paul. And when he was called forth, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, 'Seeing that by thee we enjoy great quietness, and that very worthy deeds are done unto this nation by thy providence, we accept it always and in all places, most noble Felix, with all thankfulness. Notwithstanding that I be not further tedious unto thee, I pray thee that thou wouldest hear us of thy clemency a few words. For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took, and would have judged according to our law. But the chief captain Lysias came upon us, and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come unto thee, by examining of whom thyself makest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. And the Jews also assented, saying that these things were so.'" So I think right off the bat, what jumps out to me is this guy's a pretty smooth talker. And that seems very clear. Not only in the way the King James vocabulary is, which is somewhat indicative of the King James interpretation, but even if you read it in other versions, he's trying to be slick. The way he approaches him and addresses him is obviously one example. Also notice, I guess why attorneys get bad reputations, notice the emphasis that he places. Right? Here we were taking the Apostle Paul. We were going to judge him by our laws. And then violently Lysias came and he, right? Now we go back and we read the story. That's not how it happened at all. They were beating him to death. Lysias comes and rescues him, right? So obviously we can see that the portrayal that he's giving is exaggerated on purpose to try to slant the cards against Paul. Although, from one perspective, I guess, you could try to make these claims, right? They're not patently false. They're just 95% false with a little bit of truth. So let's see here. So here's his charges. Look at the third bullet point here. Here are the charges that I can find, and maybe you can see some that I'm not recognizing here. I don't even know if these are charges. These are just accusations, though I couldn't really find any specific charges. I don't know Roman law well enough, but again, this just seems like kind of random, weird attacks. He's a menace to the people of Jerusalem. Again, maybe that pestilent fellow. And when I looked that up, it just meant a menace. So I don't know if that has some sort of legal meaning in their time that we're just not aware of today. Let's suppose that it does. He's a menace to the people of Jerusalem. He stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. So the only reason I'm bringing this up is to again emphasize a couple points. 470 people took him to Caesarea. So we've kind of noted he's a famous person. It's already mentioned in previous texts, thousands if not tens of thousands of people is what he was accused of influencing by others. Then, in order to transport him, I mean, think about just pure use of resources as a leader. That you're willing to make sure, I could see from a leader's perspective, from Lysias' perspective, tens of thousands of people are followers of this man Paul from Lysias' perspective. If he dies in your custody, maybe I'm looking at a riot. So I want to make sure, I already know there's an attempt to assassinate him coming to be. I want to make sure he gets there safely. 470 men are going to transport him on a horse, part of them, to get there safely. And then, again, this accusation comes out. He stirs up dissension among all Jews throughout the Roman world. So they're noting his fame and what he's done throughout some of these provinces nearby amongst the Jewish people. This is something I was not familiar with. I didn't do a lot of digging on this one, but he said he is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. So I had not heard the reference to them, and maybe some of you are familiar. Can you think of, other than obviously Jesus of Nazareth, references to the Nazarenes as kind of like the what their perspective was, this cult subgroup within the Jewish culture? Anybody remember a reference to that? I couldn't remember anything. Evidently, this is another way. It kind of made me wonder if that's where the name, the denomination today came from, the Nazarenes.
I think the Nazarenes were originally in the... I think Samson was raised to be a Nazarene. And it's something about taking a vow and setting them apart. They don't cut their hair.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought of that whole connection to that covenant and the Nazarite vow. So this is okay. I was thinking of it as like a substitute for what they've been calling the way, like the Nazarenes.
I would think it's, you know, to do with Jesus of Nazareth.
That's kind of what I was thinking. Like, I know the Nazarite, this is just a weird way to reference it, the sect of the Nazarenes, unless the person speaking here is not super familiar with the religious lingo. Right? Using that, I don't know. Because, of course, the Nazarite vow, John the Baptist was supposed to be a Nazarite. I guess the only way this would make sense, too, is if it... Remember, Paul was going to the temple. He was paying for those men to also go through that covenant. So maybe that was what he was referring to here, is the Nazarite vow that they were taking. I don't know. It's just kind of a weird... And a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. I would never, if you'd asked me what the word ringleader was in the Bible, I wouldn't have thought that either, but there it is.
Gill says it was a contemptuous reference to Christians, Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah, just a strange reference here. But that's what the accusation is. He's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, which must have been something they were aware of at the time, a little more than us. He says he has profaned the temple. And I found all of these accusations fail to really demonstrate how Paul broke a specific Roman law. And notice they didn't really give evidence to any of the claims. They told a little bit of the story. It was very exaggerated. But he didn't call witnesses to the stand to give an account of what took place. There's a few Jews on his side that begin to shout out in agreement, it seems like. Again, we already talked about how Tertullus kind of conveniently neglects to tell a lot of the details of the situation. And then just kind of defers to judgment to Felix, whom it seems to me like he thinks will find Paul guilty. He says, basically, once you hear the whole story, you'll certainly come to this conclusion, which is, again, kind of a common icky attorney trick, right? So all this to me felt very straightforward. His accusations, how he tried to slant it against Paul, something you would expect from a slick attorney on behalf of his group of people. So anybody have any thoughts? Anything that jumps out to you about any of that?
They did call him a seditionist, which was a very...
Let's see, where was that at? Yeah, okay, verse 5.
Mover of sedition.
Yeah, and I think what did I put in there? I just put dissension. I think for some reason in my mind, the sedition and dissension was just... I was using that as a substitute. Yeah, that's a really good point. So I guess the formal charge then would be a sedition, which would have been a capital crime that he would have made. I think, like I said, in my brain, I just translated those as the same word. Okay, so Paul's brought up for sedition, so we can kind of put that as our main. I'm going to make a correction on that. And
ringleader is apparently a military phrase. One who stands first in an army, a standard bearer, a leader, a commander.
All right, so giving the implication there might be a violent, he's guilty of sedition, he's a ringleader, which has a military undertone, he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, so, okay, I can kind of see a little bit more, he's a menace to the people of Jerusalem, he's stirring this up throughout the Jews, and he's come to their holy place in the temple, and he's profaned it. So I guess I can a little bit better after see a little bit of the trial or the case they're trying to make against him. It's already a volatile city, Jerusalem is. It's accustomed to pretty regular, even if you remember in the last chapter when Lysias is holding him, he references a recent uprising by the Egyptian with 400 men. Right? So this is not an uncommon thing for that to happen. And so he's trying to lay that at the feet of Paul. Here's your next rebel. Here's your next guy that's going to stir up a rebellion against you. And so I hadn't seen that as clearly until those details. Somebody else have a comment? All right, so then we go to Paul's response. So if you'll turn to page 2, verse 10, it says this, "Then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned on him to speak, answered, for as much as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge unto this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself, because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for to worship. And they neither found me in the temple disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues nor in the city." So Paul's clear defense is, here are all these accusations that I'm causing trouble. And yet, I just went there 12 days ago, so I've not been setting out some master plan over the last 6 months to underthrow the Roman government or have a rebellion. I've been there 12 days from this day. So I've already been here for 6, 7, right? So I've been here a while. I was there a short time. And then he's saying, they didn't find me arguing with anybody. I wasn't in the synagogue stirring people up. Nothing. I was just in the temple. And then he tells what he was doing. Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me. So at the heart of every case would be bring forth the hard evidence. And he claims they have none. Verse 14. But this I confess unto thee, that after the way, and there's another reference to that phrase that, again, I just wish the King James would have made that a proper noun, capitalized that, which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and in the prophets. So it seems to me what he's trying to illustrate here is this is a doctrinal conflict within our religion. Within the Jews, trying to suggest they have a bias. It has nothing to do with civil matters. They're bringing me here because they don't like my little sect of religion within the Jewish cause. And so they've brought me because what they call heresy has occurred. And have hope towards God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and the unjust. And herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void to offense towards God and toward men? Now, after many years, I came to bring alms to my nation and offerings, whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult, who ought to have been here before thee and object if they had aught against me. Or else, let these same hear say, if they have found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice, that I cried, standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day. All right, so Paul makes quick response, and it's basically at the heart of it is, these guys can't bring out any evidence. Here's the real reason I'm being charged is because we have a religious disagreement, and they're basically trying to persecute me for our religious disagreement. They are not the ones that find me making a tumult and causing problems in the temple anyway. It was these Jews from Asia who already had an ought against me that came in there. But, oh, by the way, they're not here. They're not making an accusation. Right. So Paul is responding in the stating the facts as they occurred. But then he says in verse 20, if they have anything else, let them bring it out. And then he says, if they have found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council, except it be for the one this one voice. So do you all take that as a confession that he shouldn't have said that in verse 21? That I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called and questioned by you this day. How do you read that? Because on the surface reading, it seems to me like he's saying, they have no accusations against me that I've done anything wrong. I've lived in a good conscience before God and before men. I haven't committed any offense. Except this one thing that he's... It almost seems like he's not saying it's a transgression of the law, but probably just not an improper thing to do within that setting. That's how I read it on the surface. But I'm obviously asking the question because I don't feel comfortable with that.
In chapter 23, didn't they bring that out where Paul brought up the resurrection because he saw in the Sanhedrin that you had to say the Jews with the Pharisees?
So I guess that's how he could argue and say, this is how I was creating a dissension.
That's how he was creating a
conflict between the two.
Yeah.
So maybe he's saying, here's the one way where I have done something to cause a dissension or a tumult, as he uses the word earlier. When they found me, I was not creating a tumult, but okay, here's the one way I was. I was amongst the Pharisees and Sadducees. I brought up this religious thing. So I could definitely see that kind of being a possible reference to that. This is, I will confess this.
What he's confessing to is something they didn't bring up.
That they didn't bring up in there. Correct. Yep.
Well, he's saying this, and he's saying this has got nothing to do with their charges. It's got to do with what I said.
Yes, I mean, it seems clear to me here that this case feels very set forward, even as if you're trying to be a neutral judge. If I'm not slanting it towards Paul at all, who obviously I know is telling the truth here, they have no evidence. They're not the original accusers. It's a religious problem. There's no real civil evidence of civil law breaking. He can bring out witnesses, no doubt, that would illustrate his points. So, you know, just kind of a straightforward case here. What's going on?
That he's talking about are those men from Ephesus
who
took a vow that were with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying that they would be there if he had really done something wrong. They didn't find anything wrong with him.
Probably because they're afraid they had done something wrong. They beat a Roman citizen without a trial. Right? So obviously, if you've done wrong, I'm not going to show up in this case with this guy, right? I'm probably just going to conveniently make my way back to Ephesus. Right?
These are the real witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And they are the direct witnesses. And the people that are here accusing me,
they're secondhand.
They haven't seen anything.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So you would think Felix would just say, no case. Dismissed. You have no evidence, but obviously they don't need evidence. They're the Sanhedrin. They have a weightier standing in court than what they should. So verses 22 through 27.
Before we read it,
yeah, go ahead.
Back in verse 5 where it says, supreme leader of the sect of the Nazarenes, the word sect there is the exact same word as Paul says in verse 14, where he says a heresy. Sect and heresy are the same word.
What they call?
So they accuse.
Okay.
The false teacher of the Nazarenes.
Okay, that's interesting.
So they did. have religious complaints in their churches.
They did.
The Greek word is heresies.
I'm going to look into that. In this I confess that after the way, it sounds funny, but can you also look up the word Nazarenes?
A Nazarene inhabited a Nazarene.
Okay, that's all it is. What about in verse 13 where it says the way? Can you look up that word?
That's capitalized in
ESP. Should be.
Hodos.
So it's not the same word as the Nazarenes?
No.
Okay. Somebody else have a comment or a thought?
But Paul equates them.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I noticed there, is that they're equating them to the same thing. You'll notice he's repeating their charge. So he's saying what they called a sect of the Nazarenes, he's repeating that, and he's saying that after the way, which they call heresy. Right? So he's using their same verbiage to reference Nazarenes and the way. He's equating those two groups as the same group Paul is. It seems to me he's using that interchangeably. So
I just scanned over real quickly over an article that came up. I looked up the Nazarenes. I think it was Charles Spurgeon that wrote it. And he said that calling them the sect of the Nazarenes was like an insult, in the same way that they use that against Jesus. Like, can anything good come out of Nazareth?
Okay.
And so they called them the sect of the Nazarenes as kind of a put down.
That would make sense. Somebody else have something you want to bring out about this? This is good. All right, so he finishes what he's talking about here. And now we get to kind of some interesting dynamics that occur. So obviously the case is not dropped. It says in verse 22, so Felix is overhearing this case. And it says, and when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way. So there's that phrase again. Now, what I interpret that to mean is that he sought more information about the way. It seems like what he's saying is at the core of both of the accusation and the defense, it's about the sect that he is supposedly stirring up as a tumult to create a rebellion. He's defending it and saying, no, 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 that's not what's occurred. I'm not committing sedition. I'm not trying to stir up a fight. The only way I've stirred up a fight is by talking about the resurrection. That did happen. Otherwise, I'm innocent. So it seems like to me, in verse 22, Felix is asking clarifying questions about the center of this, and that is, who are these people called the way? And then as a result of learning that information, he deferred them and said, when Lysias the chief captain shall come down, I will know the uttermost of your matter. So he does not want to make a decision now. And he commanded a centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and that he should forbid none of his acquaintance to minister or come unto him. So he gives Paul, he sentences Paul to house arrest. Basically, you have to stay here. We're going to wait until Lysias comes. When he does, we'll reconvene. We'll make a decision. Now, this all seems like, in its context, a ploy not to make a decision. So even if we go back into English common law, before the United States, one of the reasons why, what is it, our Sixth Amendment, one of our Sixth or Seventh Amendment, we have the right to a fair and speedy trial, is because in England, in common law, what they would do is they would just defer the trial indefinitely. So you're being charged for this. That was a trumped up crime. Usually a government official would make against somebody in order to silence them. And we'll set your trial date for 10 years from now. And in between that time, you've got to stay in prison waiting for it. And then oftentimes, whatever the situation was would pass, And at the 10-year mark, they would just say, okay, you're set free. The charges are dropped. And so one of the reasons in our Constitution, we say, no, you have the right to a fair and speedy trial. Even the accusation alone, if I've been accused of something I'm not guilty of, that has a detrimental effect on my life. If I've been accused of something terrible, my employer might say, listen, until you get that settled, we can't have you work here. We can't trust you if this is possibly true. So this is a common practice historically, is to defer a trial as long as you can to not have to address the problem. Well, here it seems like, this is me reading into it, you have to come to your own conclusion about this, Felix has two powerhouses here. I have Paul that has thousands of people all throughout the Roman world who's a follower of his. He seems innocent. But I also have him against the most powerful religious organization among the Jews. I don't want to make a decision about this. I'm going to defer it until Lysias comes and is in my presence. That happens to be, at this case, 2 years. After 2 years, and we can read that at the very end, verse 27. After 2 years, Felix gets replaced. And somebody else takes his position to where he never really had to deal with the problem. Right? But it seems like within this context, he is deferring it just so that if there's a, you know, possibly combustible situation, he doesn't have to deal with that results of whatever happens. That's me reading into it. So don't read that into the text unless you think that's really what's happening here. He commanded a centurion to keep Paul and let him have, but he does give him house arrest, right? He says, basically, a centurion is responsible for guarding Paul, but don't prevent people from coming unto him, his family, his friends. And so it seems like Paul has a little bit of freedom here, and that's why it seems like he's in house arrest. Now, we add a unique component in verse 24, because we learn something about Felix. He's married to a Jew. That kind of adds a little bit of intrigue to the situation. So there's a division from the outside Roman world looking into the Jewish culture. There's this growing division. Historically, it's been between the elites, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, over doctrine. Now it's more substantive. It's not the elites that are divided. Now it's the common people in every city that are divided. Some of them believe the Messiah has come and have formed this new group that actually fellowships with Gentiles. Which again, we spent a whole lot of time emphasizing the gravity of what that meant. That's part of the reason why this group, The Way, is having such a pronounced effect. Everybody would have noticed if you had converted as a Jew. Because suddenly, you won't even talk, you won't look at, you won't buy stuff from a Gentile, and suddenly, you're going to what they would have thought is this miniature synagogue, a church building, or a house gathering, and Jews and Gentiles are equally welcome there, and they're fellowshipping and perhaps beginning to marry, we don't know, right? And they're not performing the normal Jewish ceremonies altogether. Circumcision is not required anymore, probably still carried out, not required. All the purification rituals, not required, so forth. Emphasizing, a lot of this had probably not trickled down to daily Jewish culture yet, Christian Jewish culture, but it's on the table in a way it had never been before. You would have noticed it. So now, we learn about Drusilla, which is Felix's wife. She was a Jew. And so she is, that's probably perhaps part of the reason for Felix's intrigue. If she's a Jew, has the Messiah come? You know, that's kind of the question of Judaism, right? I mean, the question that matters is Jesus the Messiah. It's really all that matters from a Jewish perspective. And so what follows is not too surprising for us. In verse 24, it says, and after certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in the Messiah. And we really want to emphasize that that's how you should read it. Don't synonymously put Jesus' name in there. I mean, would you agree with that? It seems like Felix is coming. Now, I would say for one of two reasons he would bring his wife along. Clarifying reasons. If I'm a pagan, I've married a Jew, and I'm even asking questions about the disagreement that's occurring within Judaism, my wife would be able to help me make discernment about what I'm hearing. She's a Jew. It seems like to me reading it, it's more than that. Because it seems like there's a degree of sincerity. So it would seem to me like, okay, I come back, I tell my wife about this case, it's really fascinating, I'm getting informed, she comes to hear a key witness, and then she becomes more than just legally involved. She cares about what the truth is what it seems to me. That's why frequently, and I think that's an important point to note, that I probably noticed before, but it just had never stuck with me. He called him many times to come to him over this 2-year period. So we kind of think of that whole phrase, the famous phrase, and that's kind of what I've titled the lesson, is about come to me at a more convenient season. And we think of like this, we almost put Felix and Agrippa's situation in the same general arena, but it's really not. Felix, here's the original. He asks follow-up questions. He puts him on house arrest, defers the judgment, spends 2 years, brings his Jewish wife, and they hear Paul talk about not the case, and that's a really important point, about faith in the Messiah. Are you speaking specifically about Jesus? Obviously he was at some point. But also, that's the question that's been asked through all the Jews in the book of Acts. The Messiah, that's the question. And so, he comes back. And finally, on this occasion, and now, I want to also portray this. And I think this is an important point, because we're going to get to, when we get to motive here in a minute, one thing I don't like that we can often do is we kind of label people good guy, bad guy. We're pretty complex human beings, and I can have a good motive, majoritively, and snuck into that good motive some things that are beneficial to me. Actually, I find a lot of my good motives, and I think that's what Paul's talking about in Romans 7. A lot of times when I really want to do good, I find that just a little bit of an evil motive slips in. And would you agree with that?
By evil, you mean
self-centered. Self-centered, you know, that I'm really going to do this right thing. This is, and there's 98% of the noble reason, but my sinful heart still can find a way for pride, covetousness, all the sins of my heart to manifest. That does not, I mean, thankfully, God doesn't just say, well, that 2% just ruined it all. That's how I read Felix a little bit. It seems to me like he's continuing to ask, and you don't have to interpret it this way. I'm reading into it clearly. Come back to me. He has this Jewish wife. He's learning more information. And at the same time, he's hoping Paul, the leader of the 10,000s, might pay him to let him go. The only reason why I think there is an implied sincerity that the Scripture seems to definitively nail down about Felix is his response to what he hears. Look at verse 25. And as he, that being Paul, reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled and answered, "Go thy way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee." Now, there's an obvious evangelistic truth that is on the surface of this. And that's probably, in my own preaching and in most preaching you've ever heard, you know, don't think you're waiting for a more convenient season. That's on the surface of this, of a mistake that Felix made. And I don't want to downplay that. I just don't want to emphasize it at this moment. Couple questions about the scenario here. Look at what he reasoned with him. So he knows he's talking about faith in Christ. It tells us that in verse 24. And then he reasoned with him righteousness, which to me, in explaining the gospel, that's all right. In explaining the gospel, that would be a perfectly normal thing, right? You're going to talk about sin. You're going to talk about righteousness. It's a way to talk about Jesus. Now, the one that kind of is always temperance, self-control. I looked it up. It just, in the other version that I looked up, it's self-control. Judgment to come. I understand the righteousness, because righteousness, you can talk about sin, you can talk about God's holiness, you can talk about man's failure to be righteous, or the means to achieving righteousness. If Felix was a pagan, and he thought he's going to do all these righteous deeds to get to some paradise, that's not how you get to paradise, buddy. Clear. Judgment to come, that's a clear thing. Makes sense. Why temperance? Genuine question, I don't have a response at all. Why temperance? Why would he talk to him about self-control?
Gil puts all three of those together by pointing out the fact that his wife was the daughter of Agrippa and that Felix had basically stolen her from another man. I don't know where he gets this. I don't know if it's in Josephus or not.
Okay.
Here's righteousness. Here's
what you've done.
The importance of self-control, which called to mind Felix's indiscretion and the judgment to come. And what Gil says about Felix trembling, it says his conscience was awakened, accused of the injustice and incompetence he had been guilty of, and his mind was filled with horror, thinking about the judgment that he couldn't escape. Now, that's Gil's
opinion. Yeah, I don't. Here's what I don't like about that method of interpretation. You have to use an extra biblical source to understand the core of the meaning. Like, not just like a detail of the meaning, but that's kind of a core conclusion that he was intemperate in taking another man's wife, therefore preaching about intemperance was a way to condemn him of personal sin. Am I understanding?
Well, I'm not even sure that Gil was saying that Paul was preaching about Felix's intemperance.
Just temperance in general, which would lead to that conclusion. Yeah. So, go ahead.
What do you think? I mean, just you got front and end concerning the Christian faith. Why wouldn't the middle be similar too? Like temperance, putting yourself second to God, putting God first, and having temperance in what you're doing.
So almost like like implying sanctification.
Yes.
Like there's a righteous life to live in terms of sanctification after this.
Isn't that kind of a big difference between Christianity and
the pagan world? Absolutely.
Paganism is about do what feels good. Christianity is deny yourself.
He'd be a powerful man in a pagan society too. He could probably have pretty much whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted.
So, whether you interpret it the way you're John Gill saying, or even in that way, by preaching sin within that context, it was a means of convicting him of sin. Is that kind of the general sentiment I'm getting?
I think you're just preaching the gospel to him. That's what this is all embodies.
And I agree. I agree. If I was going to say define the gospel for me, all I'm saying is temperance does not immediately come to mind as a descriptor.
Jesus said the man must deny himself.
Sure.
Well, also, I mean, when you're talking about temperance, you're holding up a standard there. You're talking about righteousness and temperance. What's natural when you're hearing about these perfect standards? Comparing, well, have I lived up to that? When have I failed about it and everything? So, I mean, that's the message of the gospel. Jesus is perfect. The only way that you can live up to his standard is to be perfect too. If not,
he died for us.
And all three of these things, in saying that, it triggered the memory of what Pilate says to Jesus, what is truth? So almost like, you know, you can't nail me down to a standard of right and wrong. And Well, whatever he specifically said, these are obviously three broad categories, and we can know if he's talking about faith in Christ, righteous temperance, and judgment. Jesus, as you said, the gospel is the center of all of that. And it causes Felix to tremble. Now, here's, I don't want to poo-poo on the parade, is what I'm tempted to say. All right. I also want to point out something about the book of Acts that we've seen. I don't want to overemphasize this point because I understand why in our context we do it. But notice in all these encounters that the emphasis is on the God-centric aspect of the gospel. Versus how sometimes there can be, in my opinion, an overemphasis on the man-centered side of the gospel. In other words, how I obtain it and how I know I have it. You need to repent. You need to believe. You need to surrender. To whom? Who do I trust? Why should I trust him? To what standard am I being compared? All of that's God-centered, right? I bring that as a way to make sure, as we're understanding, as we're studying the scriptures, as we're conceptualizing our own religious beliefs and trying to understand the framework of our own religious beliefs, it's very necessary that we don't start the gospel picture with, here's how you get saved. It starts with God, his holiness, his righteousness. Because he is holy and righteous, he has a standard, and he demands that of all people, right? And I want to drive that point home to you is a sense of when you're evangelizing, don't assume because we live in a pseudo past Christian culture, whatever you want to call it, right, that people immediately just know that. I think there's power in the message of the gospel. And if I was to give a percentage, and I shouldn't do this, I'm not going to do that. I think we should be more God-centered sometimes than we are about describing salvation. Right? That it's not just about what you do and what you don't do. And about what these things feel like. Have you ever seen a situation where, like, I'm trying to think. That's not a good example. I just can't come up with one off the top of my head. You know, in Paul's sermon, Mars Hills, where he talks about feeling after him and finding him, though he be not far from every one of us. Like, to me, that's a really good picture of, like, you know, there's been times when my children have asked, I'm sure your children have asked you questions about salvation. I've never tried to get super detailed about it. Super detailed about it. What it feels like, what it is like, what conviction. That's something that God can work out with them. When you're under conviction, their amount of exposure to the gospel, I think they'll know. Without preacher dad putting on my pastor cap and trying to micromanage their understanding of what conviction's like. I think there is a wisdom in saying, when you feel guilty for your sins, God is speaking to you. Leave it there. And then we focus our time and attention on Christ and his righteousness and God's holiness and man's depravity and the judgment that is to come in front of God because of who we are and who he is. I have feared at times that part of the confusion of our day within our little subculture of missionary Baptists may be due from an overemphasizing of the man-centered portion of salvation. Because then you have kids sitting back and saying, well, you know, this person testified about this one time, and this person, this preacher said I would feel this way, and I don't feel exactly that way. And I'll just tell you, from my vantage point growing up, salvation was almost the opposite of the way I initially thought it was going to be. When I say opposite, I don't mean that anybody lied to me. For my the moment I got saved, where if there was any confusion that entered in, it was I expected explosions. And the exact opposite happened. Relief. And so there for a minute, I was like, whoa. This is not... I'm expecting the shouting and the I just want to get up and dance and run and jump and shout. And that's not what occurred. It's that there was all this turmoil that had been, and then all of a sudden it was just gone. And I've just noticed in this, and I think there's probably a number of causes why, and I'm not sitting here saying this is the sole reason, so don't take it that way, but I just think it would do us well to make sure we're properly emphasizing or proportioning the God-centric portion of the gospel. Because I think sometimes truth is not the only thing that matters. The proportion of which truth matters. So think of it this way. If I got up every week and preached Nahum 1 about the anger and wrath of God, and all of it was true, and I talked about God's intolerance of sin and the judgment that's to come, and I really emphasized that point all the time, how do you think you would conceptualize God? Probably incompletely. That's all true. Nothing I said was wrong. But it's necessary to proportion the truth. That there's also an understanding that with God's wrath, and I don't want to, like even that, that's not a good way to reference, because it seems like God's wrath is at opposite ends with his love. No, that's not right. But I hope you're getting my point here, that just like some of the world today has basically said, God is this God of love and peace, and he just wants you to love whoever you love and be happy, and that's... They can technically say everything correct, but lie by omission or distort by omission. And I think that's a really important thing to consider. Sunday school teacher, preacher, it's certainly something that crosses my mind. One thing a good friend of mine, Brother Jonathan Elliott, and I talk about, I would say seasonally, cyclically, is being careful not to return to, I can't remember what he calls it, what the phrase is that he'll use sometimes, but basically like your base understanding. It's like there are certain truths that for whatever reason they're very meaningful to you about the scriptures, and they're true and they're rich to you and you love to study them, and you have a solid grounding there, and there's something attractive about that whole system of thought. And I remember the first time that like he was talking about himself feeling cautioned not to just by default run to his base. That explore the truth and make sure, and he didn't say this, but as I kind of developed that thought, the proportion of the truth is right in my mind as well as it can be. And I'm not saying that you're going to, and I are going to understand every intricate little detail, but there are some general things of a God-centered salvation and a man-centered salvation. I want to make sure that I'm not preaching 90% man-centered and 10% God-centered. Do our kids understand why Jesus had to die on the cross? Not just, if I put faith that he died on the cross, I'm going to heaven. Right? I say that because as I've gone through Acts, that's a subtle note that I've made in my mind. Wow, look how Christ-centered, look how God-centered the gospel that Paul is preaching here is. I don't think it's anything to dismiss. I'll give you just here in just a minute comment on that if you want to. I want to ask, let me see here. There was another question I want to ask you before we're done tonight. Okay, go to page 4 real quick. And we'll just conclude with this final note, and then anything you want to talk about what I just said or about what we're about to say here, give you freedom to do so. So I want you to notice, and this is a point of application to all of us. I think this is an important point of application, especially as transitions in life occur. Paul, we have witnessed in the book of Acts, has gone through three, this is my categorizing here, clear transitions in his ministry. He was saved, and upon being saved, he becomes an evangelist missionary. I put those as kind of this, you know, side by side to one another. So he is called to the Gentiles. So I know that I'm not supposed to stay right here. I know I'm supposed to go to the uttermost part of the world. So that's what he does. But in the first go around, in his first mission journey, chapter 13 and chapter 14 of Acts, he's clearly an evangelist. Island of Cyprus, up to Galatia, goes back. That's what his emphasis is. He goes on a second missionary journey. At the beginning of that missionary journey, again, he's largely an evangelist. If you remember, he goes back through Galatia, teaching the churches there in Galatia that he'd already seen converted. He goes to Troas. He waits. God says, go to Macedonia. There he finds Lydia, the Philippian jailer, Thessalonica, Berea. But even notice, even though he's an evangelist, and this is something that's interesting about Felix. When I think of an evangelist, this is just me, I think of Phil Mayle, Don Watts, like Rick Jones. Those guys are evangelists, right? They get up and they pound the pulpit and they proclaim it. And that's true. They're evangelists. And you can see their calling is that direction. But notice another way that an evangelist is kind of shaped in the life of Paul. With Felix, it doesn't say that he got a little book board and Drusilla and Felix sat before him and he pounded the pulpit. It says he reasoned with him, which I take as conversational. He was sitting and they were talking. He was an evangelist. When he went to those different cities, he would go into Corinth and he'd go to the synagogue, and it says, it wasn't in there, I think it was Thessalonica, where it says they open and allege that Jesus was the Christ. And he did that for 3 Sabbath days. So it seems like he's sitting with them. He's evangelizing by reasoning and conversation and debate. And it's all centered on whether Jesus is the Messiah. He goes and it said a big door had been opened to him. He writes in Corinthians, which later, again, I told you, I think it's that school of Tyrannus in Asia Minor where he goes for 2 years and he begins to teach. Again, that all seems very evangelistic oriented. But I'm wanting to broaden our understanding of an evangelist. In our little circle, an evangelist is somebody who focuses on salvation in a public setting to people who are lost at a church gathering. That is not how Paul is an evangelist necessarily. He does some of that. But there is this subtle inference that I draw over and over in Acts that he is talking with people. Even think about whenever he was at Mars Hill. How did he get to the Areopagus? Well, he was in the marketplace talking with people every day. That you should see the direct transfer from Paul to you and I. I put a lot more stake on you and I being evangelists than me being one. Now, Paul told Timothy in 2 Timothy chapter 3, do the work of an evangelist. But let's apply that. Do you think he was just meaning, hey, you know, every few months you need to preach to lost people when you get in a public gathering? Or do you think he was saying, do what I did? I was an evangelist. I was one-on-one. Now, in the Greek, we don't translate the word the way it's written in the Greek. It's evangelizing people. Right? That's how it's actually a verb. Right? You're doing something. Right? we don't usually think of ourselves as evangelizing people. Paul seems to put a great emphasis on the one-on-one interactions. I want to impress you with that a little bit. That's kind of season one of Paul's ministry. Then he makes this clear transition. At least it's clear to me. The evangelism has largely been pivoted. That doesn't mean he's not doing it. That's not his aim. He's transitioned into a new place. He's got all these churches everywhere. He's considered, like he was to Timothy, the father of the faith, and of their faith. With that came a great burden that he recognized in 2 Corinthians when he said, all of his sufferings plus the care for all the churches. So he took this burden of what then became kind of a missionary, writer, teacher, pastor. He wasn't like the pastor of one congregation, but he had this unique role where he was influencing these pastors and these people all over, and many of them held him in this high esteem because of this role that he had played in their conversion and then future discipleship. So he has this place that he's doing here, and that's really largely the second part of his second missionary journey and his third missionary journey, which lasted for years. And then finally he comes to the end of that, and he's now got to go back to Jerusalem. And when he gets there, now it's transitioning again. Now he's not, I mean, in one way he is evangelizing because we know that he's sharing the gospel with all these people, right? But I would say he's doing that on this platform where he's like an example setter. He's been given this platform and everybody's watching him. He's got fame, both the secular realm and in the religious realm. And he's no longer really a missionary. He's kind of like a writer, evangelist, example setting. I don't know what he is. I'll just read here what I got in the last bullet point where it says, God used his life for the Christians that witnessed the boldness of his faith, but he's also used it for numberless Christians throughout the ages of suffering persecution. Paul's courage, composure, resolve, determination, and eternal mindset still resonates throughout the world. Inevitably, our life will transition from one season to another. These seasons all have a spiritual side that should not be ignored. We must willingly adapt to the vocation to which God calls us, even in dire circumstances. Thank the Lord for the example, our dear brother Paul, for the example of our dear brother Paul the Apostle. I say that because I think sometimes people can get a very static mindset about their work for the Lord. This is just what I am. This is just who I am. This is what I do. Well, you're just a piece of clay. And God may mold you into a vessel of his, an honorable vessel for his use in this way for a while. And then you might go through a season where he says, okay, time's up for that. And he kind of, you know, and you're kind of wondering and things are going on in your life and you don't realize, you know what God's doing? He's shaping me into the next vessel. Now, my advice to you is don't try to predict what kind of vessel you're becoming. Just wake up each day trying to surrender to whatever the Lord's making you into. Leave the understanding to what he's doing to him. And then it's like, sometimes, and you've probably experienced this, years later, when you've never thought about it, you look and you say, wow, that's what the Lord's been doing. Okay, I didn't even realize that. I've never perceived it before. During that season of my life, that's what God was doing with my life. Maybe it was preparing me for this season. Maybe it was accomplishing something for other people that I didn't know about. Whatever it was, right? And then he goes into this kind of final season, what I would call. I wanted to point that out. I hope you'll give consideration to that. To just yield to whatever the Lord is doing. And the reason I pointed out that, like, think about the thousands and millions of Christians who for the last 2,000 years since Paul have undergone great persecution, who found strength in the way that Paul went through persecution. How did John Bunyan know to act the way he acted for the 12 years he was in prison? He followed an example. And up to this point, the Christian didn't have an example how to suffer. Like Stephen was just put to death. It was done. But what about, and when I say suffer, I want to be more specific, persecution. Because that's really what he went through. How do you undergo persecution? And Paul, this latter half of Paul's life, or excuse me, of Acts, really gives us a good template of how to endure persecution. And to me, this is maybe a very simplistic way of it. He goes with the flow, doesn't he? Lord, not my will, but thine be done. I'm here for 2 years. I'm on house arrest. Great. I'm imprisoned. And the praetorium guards are all whatever. Okay. The gospel's going out through that, I guess. I guess I'm supposed to write. Make sure you don't forget my coat and my parchment. Right? That's kind of what he does in the last part of his last book he wrote, 2 Timothy. I mean, think about that. Like, he's almost down to bones. He's likely crippled and broken and beaten, and he's about to be beheaded. And he writes Timothy, he's like, hey, when you come, just bring me a coat and a piece of paper. Because I just want to keep on. This is where I'm at. This is where I'm at. And how much of us can find the example of Paul to endure whatever it is that we're going through, right? So, and I think that's the one thing that I talk about all the time, because it's probably the clearest, I don't even know how to say what I'm trying to say. One of the things that just I celebrate in my heart about who God is that is the multiplicity of purposes God has in everything. Like Paul saw in his little situation, well, my suffering is helping that guy and that gal, and it's helping the Roman soldiers to learn about the gospel, and I spoke to Felix and Drusilla and Agrippa, and like he could go through that little finite list, right? But did he know that 1,000 years later in China there would be Christians that look back to the way he suffered, and thus they followed his pattern, and their testimony and resilience and courage and composure under suffering and faithfulness would impact those people there? Like he could never have even dreamt of that. But there's so many layers to the providence of God. And that, to me, brings solace to these transitions that we go through. I don't know why God's doing what he's doing. But I just want to yield to him. I want to be obedient to him. I want to be the vessel he wants me to be, even if that is a lot different vessel than what I was before. I would say this is an observation of people who have lived full lives and are either now deceased or at the end of their life. The beginning vessel that they were has changed, both in use and size. They were just a little tiny, one of the 10,000 potted plants we have at our house that has like a pot that big, right? And now it seems like they're just this big cauldron that carries the water to give it to the plants. And it's amazing how the same power that God used to multiply the fish is what he does to grow the clay. Just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and its use is multiplied. So I wanted to bring that out. It kind of struck me as we were going through this. Somebody have a comment about either of those two final points? We kind of kept you longer than I intended to. Any thoughts you want to express tonight about anything you've heard?
Well,